You're listening to the Decentered Media podcast with me, Rob Watson. Conversations about community media. Visit decentered.co.uk or follow on Instagram and Twitter at Decentered Media. Hello, it's Rob Watson for Decentered Media, and it's the 23rd of November. And this is a regular update about community-focused communications, or in other words, community media. And what I thought I'd have a short amount of 20 minutes or so, maybe, probably tend to go on a little bit longer than that, just to outline some thoughts about the role of community-focused communications. It's interesting. I was having some conversations during the week with some colleagues who run and manage a community radio station. And one of the problems that we were talking about is how having to deal with communications professionals in health services, local authorities, public organisations, businesses, who don't have a clue, don't have any idea of what community media is about, what it does, why it does things in the way that it does things. So this is a kind of focus that I think is increasingly important, is that an understanding of what the role is of community media and what the benefits are, but also why it's different from other forms of socially engaged media. And I use these terms very loose and they need more precise definition. But the kind of observations and the ways of working that come forward through community media, that emerge out of community media practice, are distinct. I think there's my experience, I'm fully prepared to accept that it's me, that I don't explain things very well, and that I'm not in a position where I'm demonstrating and showing people how it works. However, there is a kind of hesitancy, and I think there's maybe something in the culture at the moment where people who are working in established, mainstream, dominant, industry-focused practices and fields kind of don't want to see what's at the edges and what's at the peripheries, because it might not be to their liking and it might push them out of their position that they're in at the moment or shift them in the hierarchy. It's disruptive. And we've seen this with the, you know, kind of the artificial intelligence that is now artificial AI, machine learning has been around for a while. But it's this year particularly, it's kind of dropped into the public domain. It's popped into the culture. And you can see that an awful lot of people are getting seeing the implications of this and starting to get worried. And nobody's really worried about community media replacing mainstream media. However, there is a huge set of questions to be asked about the kind of information and news that people get in a media world, and here in the UK specifically, where the homogenisation, the centralisation, the corporatisation of our media is kind of accelerating. And we see this with the media. I think in the last podcast we talked about the media bill and the consultation on the community radio order, is the extent to which any obligation to carry local and produce locally made programs, to originate content locally, and for that to be self-determined by everybody who lives in their town, city, neighborhood, county, wherever, is kind of being erased out of the lexicon of broadcasting obligations. And what we're left with is a kind of barren landscape, which is, we're allowing the supermarkets to be the only people who can dominate retail environments. And what the supermarkets find most profitable is the mass-produced products that are highly formulaic, that are standardized, that are efficient, and are brand-led, but which are of low nutritional value and which are, you know, kind of the same everywhere. So there's a, you know, you walk into a supermarket pretty much anywhere in the world and the same kind of products have the same kind of prominence: crisps, crackers, you know, cereals. It's, you know, kind of it's a standardized, largely a standardized kind of offer. And the same is true of our media, that convenient form of media. And the media bill, reflecting on the media bill, I kind of I'm actually a little bit more less settled about what the media bill is offering. And I think now I'm off the fence. I think the media bill is a there's a phrase I've come up with. What is it? It's like land banking. You know, it's like the housing, the house builders. They're grabbing the land, but they're not doing anything with it. And what's happening is there's an asset stripping of the capacity of local communities to represent themselves, to speak for themselves, and to represent themselves to other people, and to, for that to be self-determined on a geographical basis or a community identity basis or a community of interest basis. So kind of what we're seeing and what the media bill is going to bring forward is a further homogenization, a further standardization, a further distance in, you know, of products away from local communities. Yeah, there'll be some elements there where local traffic information and news and updates will be cycled into the system, but that's a bit like you know, kind of changing the label on the carton and saying that it's, you know, it's got some connection with local communities, but it still comes out of a big factory, and you know, it's part of an efficient news process, information process, rather than it being something which is a cultural expression, and it's rather than it being about identity, and rather than it being about belonging. Now, in making this these observations, I'm obviously answering my own question, which is, what is the point and purpose of community media? Well, you know, it's a broad spectrum of things, but principally it's about self-determination and articulation of people's voices within a civic society, which they are part of and accountable to and supported by. Likewise, it's those voices that don't often get heard, the ones that are most easily ignored, those voices which are different, those voices and opinions where there's not you know, accepted uniformity about consensus. There are aesthetic, cultural, religious, you know, all sorts of reasons why belief systems, why people might want to express themselves. And the way that we're constructing the legislative, the regulatory policy for media and for radio looks like it's going to go down a route where there's going to be very little diversity of thinking, diversity of expression, and diversity of independent platforms. Excuse me. And I think the challenge is the differentiation between community media and online social media, because the answer typically would be, well, you know, you can set up a YouTube channel. Here I am, I'm expressing my views on a podcast and I'm expressing my opinions on a YouTube channel, and people are free to listen to my views, and I can produce this very cheaply and I get some reactions, and it's like, yeah, that's fine. But there's something different about community media, and that is that it's about building a sense of community. Me talking online like this isn't really a sense, it doesn't manifest as a sense of community. Well, not the way I do it anyway, but it's not necessarily something which is generating a sense of belonging. I'm interested in a topic. I'm interested in a set of ideas. You know, in my neighborhood, I'm not talking about my neighborhood. I'm not talking about the people who live nearby. I'm not talking about the kind of institution, public institutions, social institutions that we cohabit with and through. I'm talking about something very narrow, of very narrow interest. Whereas community media is something which is broader, and it's, you know, it's about empowering and enabling and building the capacity for a sense of community. So it's that sense of belonging, it's that sense of identity, it's that sense of shared experience, it's that sense of having some say within the decision-making process, the governance process. And community media, community radio particularly, is the only form of media in the UK that has access as a legal requirement. And it comes out of the Everett Report, and the first stage of community radio was going to be called Access Radio. And just the idea that, you know, it's about people being able to having a right to getting involved, to going knocking on a door, entering into a studio and being part of, with some training, with some support, and all the other things that you have to do when you're running voluntary organisations. But it's a voluntary effort. Whereas our media, our professionalised media, I think is often, you know, most people, one, are terrified of approaching kind of media professionals. Two, media professionals see themselves as somehow different and separate from the population, in my experience. And, you know, it's about bridging those gaps. And it's about, I don't like the phrase authentic, because I think, you know, kind of as they say, you know, once you've learned to fake authenticity, you've got it made. I think there's something more. It's about the character of our society, the character of the individuals in it. And it's about the meeting the needs and having an assessment and an understanding of what is required in order for that group of people or that community, that society, to grow and develop and to, you know, kind of move forward and to reach, to have arguments, discussions, differences of opinion about where things are going, but for the voices within that to be respected. So I look at community media as, you know, as I say, I've adopted this phrase called community-focused communications, which is very broad and agnostic. I don't care what method you use to engage and bring people together, as long as it's about bringing people together and it's about having a shared and common understanding and that kind of culture. And we don't, you know, there's a need for a renewed focus in terms of cultural democracy, I think, in the UK. We don't regard, you know, if your culture is only provided by Amazon, Netflix, Apple, Disney, that's not our culture. That's a globalized culture. What is our culture? What are the things that we do locally that define us as who we are? And so I was listening to a conversation on a podcast the other day, and it was a bit about the potential for, if you like, catastrophizing about the end of civilization. And if we, you know, there's a lot of, you know, stuff going on around the world that is, you know, kind of weighing heavy on people's shoulders. And, you know, that can really kind of dominate our thinking, and to think that there is no positive in the world when, you know, kind of we're not seeing it at the moment, maybe. And the observation that was made was that, well, people don't want to see it. They don't want to think about it. People are happy with their cars, with their football, you know, with posturing around the house, doing things. It can often be a very parochial experience to live in modern Western society. Here in the UK, it can feel like that. And our sense of engagement and collaboration with other people is quite fragile and can be quite difficult. And, you know, it's we're not facilitating trust. And again, one of the kind of cliched phrases I use a lot is that community media travels at the speed of trust. And if nobody trusts our media, and if nobody trusts our sense of community, then it's not going to go very far at all. So it's all what this boils down to is building up a sense of trust. And so I've kind of put some blogs together this last week and had a think about some of the kind of ideas that are rooted, I think, in the process or the concept of this kind of community-focused communication, which are useful for us to take into account. And I wanted to compare. I refreshed my memory of Jean Piaget, who is a early 20th century. He was a French psychologist, and he was a developmental psychologist. And one of his arguments was that we, you know, as children, the developmental process is that we have to learn to engage with the world. Pardon me, let's have a sip of coffee. And what we do is we go through a series of stages whereby we engage with the world through imitation, we engage through the world through discovery, we engage through the world through abstract thinking. And what we're doing is we're constructing the world. And at the moment, there is a pushback against the notion of social constructivism. And I think it's slightly mistaken as to why that is. And I'm not entirely sure or informed about where it's come from. It's part of the kind of reaction against postmodernism or post-structuralism and deconstructionism, which to an extent I'm on board with as a reaction against. But the social constructivism model, I think, is rooted in, and Piaget's thoughts are rooted in, something which is different, which is a kind of Kantian idea of, you know, we understand the world on the basis that we have an ability or a capacity or I was trying to think of the word that is used in Kant, but it doesn't spring to mind. But we, you know, we're programmed is the wrong word, but it's we can only see the world. We don't experience the world in its raw form. We have to process that information, and it's called the difference between the noumena and the phenomena, and the world as it is, and the world as we experience it, and we are wrapped up in our sensory experiences, our intuitions, and our rational thinking. And what we do is we process that thinking along particular lines of logical inference and deduction. And we also experience the world through our sensory capacities to look at things and measure things and test things as well. But that doesn't mean to say that we're actually experiencing the world as it is. That is beyond our experience. And I think where often people think that is deterministic or idealistic, and it's kind of somewhere in the middle. It kind of combines the two. So it's not purely down to what individuals account for and kind of manifest dreams, fantasies. But there is a process there. And the development and observation of how children learn is the manifestation of that process, because it's not something that we can do. We have to go through that stage. We're not born with it innately. It firing off, if you like. It doesn't work from the get go. It has to be developed through mature, you know, through from infancy through to maturity, through adolescence and through into maturity. But the concepts drop in and function in a very universally applied way. Well, universal as far as human beings go. So we engage with the world in terms of geometry and distance and being able to see and articulate things, in the ability to think about cause and effect, and to be able to reverse engineer effect from cause or cause from effect. That kind of thing. And we reach a developmental stage where we can work things backwards as well, and we can look at what the roots and follow things backwards rather than just accepting things as they come forwards. It's very childlike things to just the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, and to not be able to look at something and say, well, how did we get to this position? Well, it was because of, plus also, and this is the point I was kind of trying to arrive at, is the notion that we don't just see the world through signs and signifiers as indicators of, you know, kind of there's something present there. We also see the world through a symbolic framework and domain. And the idea that something doesn't just have functional value in terms of its representational qualities, but it also has something which goes beyond that. So, you know, this pen, that I'm holding is the image of the pen, the words that the pen signifies an object. It signifies a certain type of material object, but what it doesn't give you a sense of, but what we kind of live in the world of, we're like fish swimming in this world, is the symbolic importance. It's penniness. It's penness. It's, you know, and it's you know, the pen is mightier than the sword, and its role and its use, and it becomes a sign. It becomes a symbol, which is the meaning is layered with cultural meanings that have been accrued over thousands of years, and that we are able we're able to connect what a pen does in terms of language and culture and communication and articulation of ideas and being able to arrest time and pass things on into generations simply because we're able to inscribe things. And that's given us the gift of civilization. So what was wrapped into this simple object that we look at and think, yes, that has a function, it leaves marks on a page. It has ink in it. This one has ink in it. And that it serves as a simple function. Well, actually, you know, a signature on a declaration can set a nation free, can appoint a monarch, or confirm a monarch. And we saw King Charles getting frustrated at the pens he was using at his one of his investiture ceremonies last year. And you know, this whole kind of symbolic world is something that modern people are divorced from. Modern Western society, we're kind of decoupled from those older meanings, those older symbolic representations, and because we live in a world of information overload and we're expected to be able to sort and manage information. And this is one of the challenges about communication and community media, is that what we we look at the use value of our media. Does it provide entertainment? You know, actually, probably one of the worst things that happened in the 20th century was that the BBC adopted Lord Reith's guiding principles of inform, educate, and entertain. And that probably narrowed down the purpose of the BBC beyond what we really might have achieved with it, because it then became about a process of exchange. It became about something which could be measured and weighed. It, you know, think of the difference between, you know, somebody who is building a cathedral in, I don't know, 1,000 years ago, Chartres Cathedral or Ely Cathedral, and they didn't think, you know, what is the social purpose of this cathedral? They wanted it to be, you know, in a society where literacy was you know, kind of very scarce. What they wanted was to, inculcate a sense of wonder, that there is something that goes beyond the human experience. What we've got is a modern communications model, which is about giving us distraction or opportunities for distraction, or giving us opportunities for information, or giving us opportunities for entertainment. And beyond that, there is very little that is designed to be awe-inspiring and wonderful. In the same way, I'm not saying that it doesn't achieve that occasionally. There's kind of times when you go to the cinema and you get those moments, and you listen to music and you get those moments, and you're reading a book and you get those moments. That aesthetic experience. But it's the general principles of social civilized communications have shifted and changed from that pattern of engagement, which was about the numinous, the wonderful, the transcendent, those things which go beyond our individual, personal, social experience, to those things which are purely about our tastes, our dispositions, our preferences. And it becomes about us, and it becomes quite nihilistic in a sense. Now, I'm not I'm not saying, you know, that we can do very much about this. It's just the world that we're in. But having a sense that, you know, kind of, our, you know, it's a very McLuhanite argument, you know, Marshall McLuhan. It's like we're constantly moving forward, but all we can see is the rearview mirror. We can only see what goes behind us. And we look at ages in the past and think, well, you know, kind of this was doing something different. And ascribing modern values to what people thought in the past is a fraught and dangerous game. So we've got to keep moving forward. So this is where the kind of the focus, I think, for me is about this idea of community-focused communication has to get away from purely informational exchanges, purely behavioural exchanges. And so I kind of... like to pigeonhole myself as a symbolic interactionist. Not that I'm a very good one, because it's quite a difficult thing to kind of put yourself in a position where you're kind of thinking about these things in that kind of multidimensional way of how do people make things meaningful? And that immersion within a society is overwhelming because your people's sense of knowledge and reality and their learning and development and their focus is, you know, kind of often just on getting through, you know, and we, you know, the priorities are to be accumulators of material status and wealth and things like that. And that doesn't fit with the dreaming and the, if you like, the more religious or spiritual, whatever phrase you want to use, approach to engagement and communication. So it can really challenge the way that we think about our forms of communication if we've got a different perspective on this. So on a blog that I've posted up about communication principles and symbolic interactionism, it's kind of, I look at different aspects, so materialism, behaviorism, symbolic interactionism, kind of the symbolic social constructivism, and ask some questions about that in terms of, you know, what is the role of truth within and knowledge within a symbolic form of communication as opposed to a material or rational form of communication. And I'm not going to kind of clarify this. I'm not trying to say that we are choosing between one or the other. We're doing these things on a, you know, at the same time consistently. And think of it in terms of logos, eros, and mythos. So we're thinking about what it is that our rational thoughts are about, our emotional responses to things, but then also the symbolic, the kind of symbolic structures of things, which do shape and change the way that we engage with one another in the world, because it shapes the way that we collaborate, and it shapes the way that we cooperate with one another to be informed by different symbolic frameworks or different symbolic traditions, where the kind of function of thinking about communication makes a difference is that it kind of the behaviorist model, for example, which I'm not a fan of and I've moaned about before, but we saw a lot of the behaviorist type thinking in the pandemic of you just give people information, you give them a nudge, and they change their attitudes and behaviors. And, you know, to some extent it works. You know, we've seen that the radio advertising for Eat Out to spread the virus, the coronavirus, was very effective, and it spread the coronavirus. That was, unconsidered, as the COVID-19 inquiry is considering at the moment. It was a moment of kind of, well, you know, rational thinking was overtaken by emotional thinking, the feeling and the need to get things moving on, rather than looking at it and saying, well, hang on a minute. But also it overtook symbolic thinking, because that kind of people respond to things differently. The values that people carry with them, although many are shared, many are different. And the kind of, you know, if you're addressing, you know, I always use this example, you know, and here in Leicester, we were in the longest lockdown in Europe, and we've got a highly diverse population, super diverse city. And so to address people with one single symbolic framework or one functional behaviorist framework completely ignored and just didn't pay any attention to the needs of people who bring other symbolic frameworks with them. The fatalism that often can come with some religions, Buddhism, Hinduism, not particularly renowned for authoritarian, although societies can be quite authoritarian, but the as a religious practice, it's not regarded as authoritarian, and you must do your duty and your thing. And so different faiths, different belief systems have different symbolic resonances, and only communicating with people on one level limits what your capacity to do things. And similarly, I suppose opening it up too much can have a detrimental problem as well. So I think that I'm hoping to kind of develop this as a kind of set of practices which can be used by communications managers. It ties in with there's a number of questions that we can ask, and it ties in with something which again I'm developing, which is this idea of an equality impact assessment for communications. And it's going to take some time to develop, because I think at first hand it's quite functional and quite limited. And the Equality Act 2010 is a very good guide in terms of what we can expect from an equality impact assessment in terms of protected people of protected characteristics. That's race, gender assignment, sexual orientation, pregnancy, those kind of things. I think it's 13. Overall, I've not got them to hand, and protected belief. So things like being a vegetarian or being gender critical. These are protected beliefs, and they've been through courts in the UK. There are protections there for people with values and ideas that are worthy of a democratic society, I think is the phrase that's used. So within that, there's a kind of combination of these two things in terms of figuring out how does this work with different groups of people. So you're kind of looking at the kind of cultural narratives that resonate, like the archetypal narratives. Western society is dominated by the hero myth. It's not the only one. There's there's a number of archetypal. There's the redemption myth. There's also the which is the let's just think of Faust, the pact with the devil. These are these each play a different role in society at different times, and we see these mythological focus kind of comes and goes within our culture, but there's a current, there's a theme, and it's consistent, and it moves over slowly over time. Then you've got the impact is between the individual and the collective. So this idea that kind of we are all in again, Western thinking is about being individualized, and we can approach things on the basis that we're like calculating machines, and that in a marketplace we make rational decisions as individuals, which is kind of highly problematic when you look at patterns of behavior in groups, and we're like a herd, and we follow patterns of behavior, and if other people are doing it, well, we'll do it as well. So what do we mean by our individuality? And there's always a tension between the two. But then there's also the kind of the perceptions that we have between what we regard as being natural and what we regard as being of human construction, so nurture and nature. What are we adding to this ourselves, and what is it we're finding in the natural world? To what extent, we are beings of the world, we are animals, and yet we separate ourselves from the natural world, as no one else has ever done in the history of the planet. And so there's a kind of focus, if you like, on aspects of personal growth or goal-oriented growth, as opposed to transformation and a sense of becoming. You know, there's an innate character that we each are like an acorn, and we turn into an oak tree or whatever it is that we're defined by. But there's that's kind of different from a transformational, you know, we are what we achieve kind of approach. And this really looks at, you know, kind of are we able to think through our communications in terms of the surface level communication and what we can play with on a surface level, and then those things which run deep, which we would find much more difficult to change, and we play with at our peril, because they are part of what defines. There's a phrase that Joseph Campbell uses, which is the mythogenetic. And I'm kind of concerned that there are academics, media academics, communications academics who want to I was on a seminar, an online seminar, and the phrase was used that this particular group of academics wanted to de-Westernize the curriculum. And my thought was, what do you mean by that? And it's always a good question to ask. And what do you mean by that? Are you talking about the Celtic tradition? Are you talking about the Germanic tradition? Are you talking about the Roman tradition? Are you talking about the Hellenic tradition? What, you know, exactly are you asking for within this process? Because there are different things. And this idea of mythogenesis is that there are kind of centers and zones which define a body of a symbolic framework for people who live in particular places. And with the caveat that in the last 50 years, we've become globalized, which we've never had before. You know, with this short breath of time that we have to look at some of these things on the basis of, that we have to remind ourselves that we were never globalized to this extent and in this way as we are now. Yes, there were elements of, you know, the Roman Empire was about people move. You know, there was mobility, but it wasn't to the extent that we've got it now, where you can jump on a plane and be on the other side of the world, that you can pick up you can communicate with people around the world instantly on teleconference and or telephones, wherever it is. You know, we've never had that form of communication, so there was always an element of lag and delay in terms of how things were absorbed into a culture. Now the culture washes in at this, you know, it's an overload of information from cultures around the world, which we don't have a chance to make sense of and orient ourselves around. And at the heart of this, there's a concept about the determination of whether there can be anything like truth. And short of getting involved in a theoretical, philosophical argument that I'm not equipped to deal with, going back to this notion of why I'm drawn to Kant and why I'm drawn to people who followed on from Kant, who sticks, yes, there are truths. Okay, maybe we can't claim that there is an absolute truth, and that our experience of the world, of the phenomenal world, is defined by our experience and our capacity for experience, and what we construct within that using our reason, senses, and intuitions, and things like that. However, for all intents and purposes, these truths are important to us and matter, and they can't be played with. And I think part of the crisis of communication is this sense that. And we see this being played out in politics, and Trump has played this, on numerous occasions, is that you can have alternative truths. And it's kind of like, well, that devalues the process of, you know, it's that yes, there are often exceptions to a rule. However, that doesn't mean to say that the rules themselves are, kind of not worth having. And so that kind of completely open, deconstructive process is unhelpful, And a lot of our communications, it's about what that does is it generates a kind of cynicism. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't challenge kind of, if you like, power structures within the symbolic structure itself. I do think that is an essential thing for people to do. But it's on what basis do you do that? Anyway, so I'm kind of the theoretical philosophical model for this is not as straightforward as many people would have us believe about our communications. And I think what we kind of need to do is look to things like, you know, the kind of patterns of behavior, we need to be observational, empirical, about the kind of stages of cognitive development that we are able to pass through, and that we where are we in our society? What kind of stage of development are we at in modern UK society? What kind of schemes do we have, roadmaps do we have that help us work our way through this? And what happens if we stick to the plan too rigidly and we don't have any space for adaptation or change or growth? What happens about the way when people interact with each other and people of different experiences share different insights? Do we come up with new ideas? How can we capitalize on that and not be afraid of using those new ideas? So this idea of constructing knowledge is a very healthy thing, and it's part of our innate capacity if we allow ourselves to do it. But we do it in a way, it's not free-for-all, it's not open-ended. You cannot claim to have invented something that you haven't invented, and it needs to be replicated and tested by other people. And that's an established process, you know, kind of 500-year-old process now. And this is about kind of the way that we communicate through language is the way that we express our thoughts. And so it's important that we're able to just consider what we're doing when we're communicating or trying to communicate, because it might not be, you know, the law of unintended and intended consequences. It might not be what we might not be achieving what we're trying to set out to achieve. And we have to be open to the idea. Yes, for the most part, there will be patterns which are well-established pathways through which we can rely on. But inevitably, things change and things move forward, and we have to look at things afresh and look at things differently. So that's scratching the surface. And I hope I've done some justice to explaining it. There is a lot more that we can look at how these things work. And I'm really thinking, you know, this idea of, kind of impact assessments to make sure that we really do understand on what basis we are bringing people together through modes of communication, what we're trying to achieve, what the value is of that, what the resonance, the symbolic resonance is of different forms. What are our assumptions within that? And the danger for me is that we narrow our assumptions and make the assumption that everybody is interested in Strictly Come Dancing or football, or, you know, it's not the case. You know, it might be a large part of the population are involved in those things. And apologies to anybody who I think, you know, I've upset by using those two examples. But however, you know, how do we open things up, and how do we discover and invent the new? That's a good question to ask and for us to think about in the future, because when we put together a strategy for communications, you know, replaying the greatest hits, regurgitating our assumptions from the past is not going to be sufficient for the future. And we need to think about, okay, what is it we're going to need to anticipate looking forward, and what will our future generations need in terms of the capabilities to communicate effectively in a world that is, you know, we think globalization is, rapid at the moment. Imagine what it'll be like in 20 or 30 years' time. It'll be, you know, unimaginable. Anyway, if you want to get in contact with me, you can do that via Twitter and Instagram at Decentered Media. The website is decentered.co.uk. I have a Patreon account, and if you wish to support me, that would be gratefully received. You can start off at £3 a month. It also helps you to get, we do a regular, every fortnight we do a meetup and drop in where we could talk about some of these things, maybe not so lofty and philosophical as this, but we're going to be talking about ethics of communication, hopefully in a future meetup. And also, you know, just a chance to share our experiences and practice and find out what we should be thinking about with and listening to one another's approaches to these things, which are always different and always illuminating. So yeah, just go to patreon.com/decenteredmedia, and it just helps me to keep my head above water and put out more content via the website. Anyway, I've spoken enough and I'll speak to you soon. You've been listening to the Decentered Media podcast with me, Rob Watson. To find out more, go to decentered.co.uk or follow on Twitter and Instagram @decenteredmedia.